We're talking with Kenneth Doka, Professor Emeritus at the Graduate School of the College of New Rochelle and Senior Vice President of the Hospice Foundation of America. Kenneth pioneered the concept of disenfranchised grief. He joins us on the show to explain what it is and why it can be an obstacle to healing. Ken, welcome to Smart Talk.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
Ken, you're credited with coming up with the concept of disenfranchised grief. I'd like to start by talking about this idea a little bit. And so I'm going to ask you if you might just be able to, you know, kind of explain it in a nutshell.
Basically, in a nutshell, it refers to losses that we have that are not always acknowledged by others, sometimes because the relationship is not acknowledged, sometimes because the loss is not acknowledged, let's say divorce or some other kind of loss. Sometimes because the griever is not perceived by others as competent or capable to have grief. Sometimes the very old, the very young, persons with intellectual disabilities, all of whom grieve, but may not grieve in the ways that we expect, or we may not see them as possible grievers. And then there are disenfranchising deaths. Suicide could be an example of that. And then there are other factors, the ways people grieve. Sometimes people have different grieving styles, or, you know, due to culture or due to other factors that make them grieve in ways that a person might not, another person might not acknowledge or recognize as a statement of grief.
And I think it's probably important to note that you're describing a couple closely related ideas that aren't all the same idea. I know that was something I tripped over a little bit when I was learning about this, because a disenfranchising death is a bit different than a disenfranchised grief.
Well, a disenfranchising death may be a cause of disenfranchised grief.
Yeah.
In other words, for example, if a death is highly stigmatized, somebody may not be able to seek support or even get support. A good example of that a number of years ago was I had a client who came in once and said, I don't even know how to answer the question, how many children do you have? She said, because I had five and one died in a robbery. But he was the robber. He was the thief. So the question becomes, well, I hope they got that guy. And, you know, and the answer is he was that guy. You know, shot by a shop owner. You know, so it's not that they're separate. These are different factors that may cause an individual's grief to be disenfranchised.
Yeah, you know, very interesting. One anecdote you shared with me was one of the first people whose story you learned that led you to really study disenfranchised grief, and that was a woman who had lost her ex-husband. I wonder if you can share that anecdote.
Sure. I teach, as you mentioned, a graduate class, and I was teaching a graduate course on family. And we were talking about widows. And my graduate students are probably like a lot of your listeners. They often have second careers, and they've often had a great deal of professional experiences and life experiences. And this was a woman like that. And she said, so we talked about widows, and she said, if you think widows have it tough, you ought to see what happens when your ex-spouse dies. I never thought about that before. I never even considered the possibility. And I said, what was it like? And she said, it was really tough. She said, we were married for close to 25 years. We were at the point of setting a 25th anniversary cruise, really, to celebrate our 25 years together. We had two kids, both in high school, or one in high school, one in junior high school, but going into high school. And then I found him in bed with a neighbor. And she said it was a very, you know, painful and difficult divorce. I said within 2 years we had divorced. He had remarried. I had moved with the children to we had to sell the house. I had moved the children to another area. And she said, and he developed pancreatic cancer and died. And she said, people would come up to me on the street and say, congratulations, I heard you got him, or, you know, good for you. And she said, part of me felt that way, but the other part said, wait a minute. This is my husband of close to a quarter of a century. This was the guy I went to the high school prom with. This is the father of my sons. And she said, I really struggled with, you know, the ambivalence that I felt and had an intense grief, but nobody seemed to understand why I would be grieving him.
Yeah.
And then I decided to study that. and did an article on grief and ex-spouses. And, you know, eventually that led to the concept of disenfranchised grief.
Yeah. Powerful anecdote. And while we're talking about it, I think maybe let's even step back one step further. Maybe some people think that grief itself is undesirable or bad, and they don't think they should be grieving. So why is it important to grieve?
Well, it's almost like asking why is it important to breathe. It's not a conscious choice. If we are attached to somebody, and it can even be a negative attachment, we're going to have a reaction to their loss, whether it's a loss by death or a loss by moving or some other kind of loss. And we're simply going to have that. And all grief is really is a reaction to loss. So inevitably, when we attach to sometimes a person, sometimes a thing, sometimes an animal companion, I get in trouble when I use the word pet, sometimes an animal companion, and we experience a loss, we're going to have a reaction to it. And that reaction is simply what we call grief.
Mm-hmm. It's a physical and psychological reaction to loss.
Yeah, it's more than that even. It's physical, it's cognitive, it affects us cognitively, it affects us spiritually, it affects us emotionally. Let's see if I missed a physical, emotional, cognitive, behavioral. It affects our behavior.
Yeah. But whenever we try to, I think you'd probably agree, though, that there are probably better and worse ways to go about the process and some ways to help people in their process. Is that right?
Certainly. Yeah. I mean, obviously, if we're self-destructive, if we're becoming dependent on drugs or alcohol, these are not necessarily effective ways to cope.
Because as you know, part of what led me down this road and to learning more about disenfranchised grief was that here in Pennsylvania, like in many parts of the country, we've really been affected by the misinformation around the coronavirus. And from reporting I've done, that's led to a situation where people are losing loved ones to the virus and then having their own family members or people in their community still downplay it. For example, they would ask them something like whether their deceased loved one was overweight or had pre-existing conditions, as if that should be blamed rather than the virus. How does this idea relate to the concepts that you have identified?
Yeah, it's an example of what's called this a disenfranchising death. You know, that there are factors in the nature of the death that cause somebody to be less supportive. Somebody dies of lung cancer. What's the first question that people normally ask?
Did they smoke?
And obviously, the notion is that if they smoked, they're somehow less worthy of support. You know, well, of course, they in effect, you know, they made this perception that they were responsible in some way for their own death. A number of years ago, I was on a couple of commissions about pediatric AIDS, and I used to hate the term innocent victims. When they spoke about the pediatric patients, they were, but so was, in my mind, anybody who had HIV, anybody who had AIDS was an innocent victim of a horrific disease. But we sometimes make judgments about the illnesses that people die of, and those judgments impair our ability to give support to others and impair others to seek support.
Impair others to seek support. Others might not want to go out
answer
and,
those questions.
Yeah. Yeah. So you've listed a couple other instances there of maybe what you would also categorize as a disenfranchising death. Is it fair to say that the first wave of the HIV AIDS crisis in the 80s would be an example of that?
Oh, yeah, certainly.
And what would be some other examples?
Well, we've spoken about lung cancer. If I would say he died of cirrhosis of the liver.
Yeah.
What's your next response?
Right. I see.
And yeah, any disease that carries a sense of stigma with it, I think can be potentially disenfranchising, you know, that has this stigma that, well, you brought this on yourself.
Mm-hmm.
Unfair as that is, it's a factor.
Absolutely. And I think that leads a lot of people to just ask, well, what do we do about this, though? Because we're at a situation where in many communities in Pennsylvania, a lot of people really were invested in the idea that COVID-19 was no more serious than the flu, that, you know, it was only the very old or the very sick who were going to be affected by it. And while there was some truth to the fact that a lot of older people died from it, first of all, I don't see that as all that relevant to grieving.
Yeah.
But also, you know, it just wasn't fully true. So how do you navigate that difficult terrain?
Well, you know, there's a wonderful, cute little book by Aaron Lynn called I Know Just How You Feel, Avoiding the Clichés of Grief. And I often give that to people who are struggling with the insensitive comments that others make to them. And she has three questions that she asks. And she asks, essentially, what made it hurt? And what made it hurt often is that it invalidates or disenfranchises us our grief. And the second question is, why did they say it? And in most cases, you'd have to answer that they didn't say it to be intentionally cruel, maybe to try to get an understanding, maybe to try to be supportive. You know, a comment like, well, you know, your son died, but at least you have three other kids, you know. And then the third question she asks is, what could you say, even if you can't say it now, what could have you have said? Because it gives this empowering sense. And the answer might be, yeah, he smoked, but, you know, we still miss him tremendously. And we loved him, you know, we loved him very much. Or, you know, to the parent who's or even to the person who says, well, your dad was 88 years old, you know, but we didn't expect him to die this way. And we miss him terribly. You know, to just kind of to validate and enfranchise your own grief.
Right. And let's break that down a little bit more, because even, you know, the examples you've brought up where, well, you know, did this person who died from lung cancer, well, did they smoke? Well, you know, sometimes the answer is yes. And to which I would say kind of like, well, so what, you know, like, I think it feels like it's a little bit beside the point, you know? And,
yeah.
And so it feels like oftentimes, you know, the person is going to fit that bill. So what does that sort of attitude miss about what we should actually be, you know, focusing on here?
I think what we should be focusing on is support and validation of their grief.
Mm.
You know, when I teach people, I always say, you know, the best thing you can do is to be supportive, to, you know, to validate the grief, try not to say dumb things. And then I think the thing is to be very specific, you know, sometimes just enough to say, I'm really sorry. And then if you offer help, to be specific in help. You know, we all say things like, hey, if you need anything, give me a call. But often it's really good to define what you think you can do. You know, I know this is going to be busy for you. You know, if you want me to pick up your kid for basketball practice when I'm when I'm driving my son, we'd be happy to do that. We'd be happy to bring him home. We'd be happy to take her to, you know, to school when we pick up my daughter. You know, just anything you can do, you know, or would you like me to bring over a dinner once in a while, you know, or it's those specific things that people really come. Mm. One of my favorite stories is one of my clients talks about the fact that when her husband died, she had a neighbor up the street, you know, kind of an hello and goodbye kind of thing, you know, pleasant acquaintanceship, if that. And when her husband died, the woman came to the funeral. And when she took her hand, she felt she was pressing something into her hand. And then when the woman turned over her hand, it was a key. And she said to her, honey, I've been where you are. And there are nights you're just not going to be alone. Come over, I'll make a cup of coffee, I'll make a cup of tea, we'll talk. And she said, I never used that key, but I got very close to that woman. And she said, there were times that she says, I was 2 years into my next marriage before I finally returned the key. Because it was like a talisman to me. You know, that's real support.
Yeah. And so often, though, the loss of a loved one is something that's experienced so privately, and it's almost like, you know, the rest of the world is going on and you have this experience of your own. And that's still the case, I'm sure, with people who lose a loved one to COVID-19. But I wonder if anything is a little bit different here, because we do have so many other people having similar experiences. Does the dynamic change a little bit with a pandemic like that?
Well, I think it does, but I think it doesn't always change to the benefit of the person who's experiencing it, because I think you have so many people seeking out support that sometimes, you know, it stretches even your support networks then. And again, you know, one of the things about this pandemic, I always say that this pandemic is going to be followed by a pandemic of complicated grief. Because, you know, so many people, even if they haven't experienced losses, if they haven't experienced a death, have had other significant losses in their lives, loss of income, loss of routine, the loss of the sense of an assumptive world, you know, that the world seems less safe and less predictable now, less benevolent.
Loss of an assumptive world.
Yeah. And the assumptions we make about life.
Yeah.
The world challenged.
Absolutely. And I think about that a lot, the idea that this is going to have a long tail on it, this pandemic. And I have to wonder if our behavioral health services and the availability of people to help, if we're ready for that, Ken.
I'm afraid we're not. I'm hopeful that we are, but I'm really fearful we're not, because we have so many people. I mean, you know, think of the kids. If I told you 2 years ago that Broadway was going to be closed down, that schools were going to be closed down, that people would be working remotely, you wouldn't even air that interview. You know, you'd say, this guy's a lunatic. We don't want to put him on. And I would have never said that 2 years ago. I never believed it. But yet we experienced all that.
Yeah, that's profound. I think we have time for maybe one more question. I'm just going to ask, you know, what can we do when we see that disenfranchised grief or recognize that disenfranchising death to be able to move beyond it? I mean, if you could just kind of give a little bit of advice.
Yeah, I think the first thing is, if you're the griever, to acknowledge your right to grieve. And I think, you know, especially those people who have had losses that are impactful, but not necessarily deaths, have to say, no, this was a loss. And we don't compare losses. We don't say, well, my loss is worse than your loss, or, you know, so we have to validate our own grief. And then we have to seek out support from the people who can give it, and to seek it out, seek out what they can give. You know, when I do work with grievers, I use what I call DLR system. You know, list your friends. Who are the doers? You know, you need them to pick up your kids. They'll do it. Who are the listeners, who, if you call them at 3 o'clock in the morning, will be honored to listen to you? And then who are the people who are respite people, who, you know, grief is hard work, and there are times you need to take a break from that work. And these are the people who will, you know, take you out to lunch, and they won't turn to you and say, but how are you really doing? Because they hope against hope that you don't talk about it. But that's their gift. Their gift is to give you time away.
Ken, thank you so much for sharing with us today.
Thank you.
That's Kenneth Doka, Professor Emeritus at the Graduate School of College of New Rochelle and Senior Vice President to the Hospice Foundation of America. And thanks to all our guests today, John McCarthy, Co-Senior Study Author and Associate Professor at the Department of Physiology, University of Kentucky College of Medicine, and Nathan Bucks, Sports Medicine and Family Medicine Doctor at WellSpan Health System. I'm Brett Schultes, WITF Transforming Health Reporter. Thank you for being with us.